Yes, so she had to go up to see her computer staff as well.
I want to know why you don't own an ice cream cone.
I know. Ready?
Evidence is gone.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate General Government and Transportation Committee. And it is Tuesday, March 13th. I had to look at my notes here to even figure that out. That's not a good sign. And what we're going to do right now is open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2119. Patrick, tell us where we are with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2119 allows the Oregon Growth Account Board to contract with management companies outside of Oregon. It requires that management companies invest in Oregon an amount that is at least equal to the principal transferred from the Oregon Growth Account to the management companies for investment. It exempts Oregon Growth Board from public contracts and purchasing laws and recommends guidelines for investment policies. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on House Bill 2119, and we have Randall Edwards signed up to testify. Is Jim Craven in this group that you're bringing up? Okay,
would you like to have him?
Sure.
Well, okay, there's three of you there right now. We can just have him swing on in.
All right.
Okay, all right. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you this afternoon about House Bill 2119 and why we've come to the legislature to ask for assistance. This is a bill which we're bringing to you that helps with some technical changes we need to make to the Oregon Growth Account. And what I thought I'd do is just give you a little background on the Oregon Growth Account, which would give you some context to the changes we're attempting to make here. The Oregon Growth Account was established by the legislature in 1995 to earn returns for the Education Endowment Fund by making investments in emerging growth businesses in Oregon as well as affordable housing projects. The account was created to address an estimated capital gaps of about $100 million to $200 million to help the venture capital resource here needs in the state and to help Oregon businesses. The availability of venture capital is critical to Oregon's growth and our new economy. The account was established within the Educational Endowment Fund. It receives 10% of the lottery's 15% that the Constitution directs to the Educational Endowment Fund. That translates to approximately $8 million per biennium into this account. The Oregon Growth Account Board uses these funds to enter into limited partnerships with other investors to fund emerging businesses and affordable housing projects here in Oregon. To date, the board has entered into four partnerships relating to emerging businesses: Endeavor Capital Fund, number 3, Smart Force Ventures, Tamarack Mezzanine Partners, and Timberline Venture Partners, and has committed a total of $19 million to these partnerships. The board leverages these funds in two ways. It enters into partnerships with investors to create and help create venture firms here in Oregon, like those listed above. Secondly, the venture capital firms then seek outside investors to help invest in Oregon. So we're creating synergies. I thought I'd just give you a couple examples of the funds that how we've been able to leverage outside money. Tamarack Mezzanine Partners, for example, the Oregon Growth Account seeded $1 million to help meet a $5 million fund that they needed to close this total fund. As a result, working with a small business, SBIC.
Small Business Investment Corporation.
These acronyms throw me at times, Mr. Chair, was able to use that to leverage themselves two times in capital of $10 million. So therefore, in essence, the $1 million that we put in generated another $14 million to be invested primarily in Oregon. So Tamarack we were helped to seed this company, that we helped create the company here in Oregon, and furthermore, it helped drive other monies here into the state. Timberline Venture Partners, another Oregon Growth Account investment, we committed $5 million, which they helped raise a total of $60 million for their total fund. And nearly all of that money is being, close to half of that money is being invested here in Oregon. Currently, the Oregon Growth Account Board must enter into partnerships with management companies that, quote, that exist or were established to make investments primarily in Oregon. The main purpose of this bill is to eliminate the ambiguity created by this language and to broaden the pool of management companies with which the board can contract. There is no bright line test of the amount that we must invest in Oregon to meet this, quote, primary in Oregon, unquote, requirement. This bill would eliminate this ambiguity by allowing the board to contract with management companies outside of Oregon. To assure that the money is invested in the state, however, the bill requires that the management company invest in Oregon in an amount at least equal to the amount that we commit in principle to that investment firm. House Bill 2119 also specifies that the contracts for investment advice or other services entered into by the board are exempt from public contract and purchasing laws. And you'll see in the bill and current existing law, not just public bidding and DAS contract requirements as the statute is currently written. Many contracts entered into by the Treasury are exempt from these laws because they are not the types of contracts that fit within these laws. Lastly, the bill clarifies that the state treasurer, as chairman of the Oregon Growth Account, who develops investment be the developer of investment policies by the board. The treasurer currently has board authority to make investment policies for the board to earn the most returns possible for the Education Endowment Fund. Some other statutes relating to the Education Endowment Fund are not as clear. This bill is a clarification for the Oregon Growth Account. It is the treasurer who determines investment policies, including the reinvestment of principal and returns and retention of amounts of for unfunded commitments owed to management companies, and a determination of when and how earnings are calculated and declared available. Again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill is largely a correction to help us facilitate the use of these monies here in the state and to ensure that we have opportunities to invest in Oregon and make my role as treasurer as chair of the Oregon Growth Account to make sure that we're putting this money to work in the state. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions with the state treasurer? Okay. Randall, thank you.
And
I'll let you guys decide who's going to go next.
Well, actually, these two are here to help me answer
any
questions.
Make sure you had the right words, huh?
Great.
I don't have any corrections.
Okay. Great. We thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association, high-tech trade association here in Oregon and across the country. We just want to give a word of encouragement to your attention to this bill. Back in the 1995 session, our group, AEA, worked with legislators and the former state treasurer in devising the Oregon Growth Account, coming up with this idea. Again, just as it is a way of investing money in the Education Endowment Fund. It doesn't take direct allocation of lottery dollars. It just the whole Education Endowment Fund has to be invested. This just directs how a small portion of that is invested in order to help build Oregon companies, keep those dollars here in Oregon to help emerging businesses. It's been a great success to date. It's really, you know, the bill was passed in 1995. As things do take time to get into place, it's really just starting to pay off now with the partnerships that you heard about from the treasurer. It's sort of I know things do take time when we're involved with government, but it is starting to address the significant lack of venture capital that was present in the early 90s. I mean, Oregon has really turned that situation around in terms of getting the investment community's attention in this state, bringing in literally hundreds of millions of dollars in recent years to emerging businesses in Oregon. And the Oregon Growth Account is a small part, but we think it's played a role in turning that tide around and getting investors to look at Oregon as a good place to do business and help grow new companies. And really, I guess I would agree, having been present at the creation, that this is really a modest adjustment to the original idea and not a major change. We just want to make sure that we can get the best investment advice we can, whether they're located in Portland or located in Menlo Park, California. As long as the funds are being invested in Oregon, that was the original idea, and this bill maintains that original concept. So we urge your support.
Great. Any questions? Thank you, Len.
Thank you.
Patrick, anyone else signed up on 2119?
No, Mr. Chairman. No one else signed up to testify.
Well, we are stand at ease for just a couple of minutes while we wait for other member to come back. I think she's going to be right back. Where was she testifying?
I don't know, Mr. Chairman.
Do we know? Just I'll let everyone know that Senator Carter had to be in Portland, and so she was unable to be with us here today.
We have freedom.
We can go ahead and move it.
Yeah.
All right. I think we're okay. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2119, and with tap of the gavel, we'll be in work session. What is the pleasure of the committee?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2119 to the floor with a due pass.
Vice Chair Mesker has moved House Bill 2119 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Carter. Senator Cornell. Senator Enderly.
Aye.
Senator Mesker.
Aye.
Chair George.
Aye. Senate Bill 2119 has been duly passed in this committee and will be sent to the floor and with a due pass recommendation. And
sure.
Would you like to carry it?
Sure, happy to.
Senator Mesker will carry 2119. Following down the list, we're going to open up a public hearing, possible work session on House Bill 2122. Patrick, tell us where we are with 2122.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2122 requires state agencies to submit bond refunding plans to the state treasurer for approval, provided the treasurer has adopted rules relating to the type of plan being considered. It authorizes refunding to proceed if the treasurer fails to approve any plan within 30 days. It allows refunding bonds for many school districts to participate in the state bond guarantee program. It declares an emergency, and the measure takes effect upon passage. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. And once again, State Treasurer Randall Edwards has signed up to testify.
You're changing advisors on us, aren't you? Welcome back.
Not to confuse you. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Treasurer of Oregon. With me is Chuck Smith from my office, who is involved in the management of debt for Oregon, and he's here to help me answer any questions you may have. Again, we've come before you with the bill, House Bill 2122A, as a housekeeping measure in how we deal with refunding bonds, whether those are advanced refunding or forward current refunding. Just generally speaking, a refunding is analogous to refinancing a mortgage. It is selling bonds at a lower interest rate to pay off bonds that were issued at a higher interest rate. Forward current refundings are short-term refundings, typically 1 year or less. Advanced refundings are of longer nature. This bill clarifies when a refunding plan must be submitted to the state treasurer for review and approval and when one does not. It specifies that a plan to issue advanced refunding bonds must be submitted to the treasurer for review and approval. However, a plan to issue forward current refunding bonds must be submitted to the treasurer for review and approval only if the treasurer has adopted rules for this type of refunding. If the treasurer has not adopted such rules, the plan does not need to be submitted to the treasurer for review and approval. The reason for this is that it is not necessary to adopt rules and review and approve forward current refundings because of their short-term nature. The bill also clarifies that after reviewing a proposed refunding plan, it is the treasurer who must notify a public body within 30 days of whether the sale of refunding bonds is authorized. If the treasurer fails to make the notification within 30 days, this is deemed an authorization to proceed. The amendment to the bill that is in Section 2 was added so that local school districts could more readily take advantage of the Oregon School Bond Guarantee Act, which allows school districts to use the state's good credit rating, which is saving taxpayers millions of dollars. In fact, Mr. Chair, this program was a bill enacted in 1997. Since that time, school districts throughout Oregon have used it. We have a cost savings estimated of nearly $100 million in interest savings for school districts when they use this program. It's a Treasury-administered program. It's been a great benefit to school districts and to taxpayers. Again, I'd be happy to answer any questions about this bill. It is a technical change in our notification of refunding, and be happy to answer any questions.
Oh, yes, Senator.
Mr. Treasurer, I'm just curious, and I probably should know this from my past experience here, too. But if a school district should default, who is the state responsible?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator. If the school district
would you state your name for the record?
Excuse me, this is Chuck Smith. I'm with the Oregon State Treasury and debt manager for the state treasury. If the school district has participated in the Oregon School Bond Guarantee Act and have had their bonds guaranteed, the state would pay their debt service on their bonds so that they would not go into default. And then the state would go to the school district and work out an arrangement to get the payment for those bonds. The school district will always be responsible for paying debt service on their bonds, but if they participate in the state program, the state would insure and step in so that those bonds would not default. If a school district was not a participant in that program, potentially those bonds could be in default, but the Treasury doesn't have any records of school districts defaulting on any general obligation bonds since World War II. We don't have records before that.
Mr. Chair, if I might add to that, when a school district comes and applies this program, we also take a very strong look at their financial ability to pay. And as Chuck just outlined, there's never been a bond defaulted in the state, and that's a bad word for us and for the issuer. So what we've done is basically take a pretty good bet with these school districts and avail to them a way to go out and borrow money more cheaply on the open market. We have a better bond rate than many school districts, particularly small ones that don't go out very often, and give them that service, and it does save them millions of dollars over time.
Thank you.
Thanks. Rendell, are we able to save them any money? In other words, if they come to us, it was almost like a broker-type operation where they're not having to go through all of the fees that might be paid in a normal arrangement. Is that part of the savings that's represented by this relationship now with the Treasurer's Office?
Mr. Chair, no, that's not part of the savings.
Okay.
The savings are actually purely a result of the state's high credit rating being used by the local school districts. And when they do that, they can borrow at lower costs, which directly relate to or are related to lower taxes for citizens in that school district on those bonds. That's where the savings accrue.
And one question I had, Richard,
go ahead.
When I first looked at the description of what was happening here, it reminded me of some of the ideas that Bill Clinton used in the early days of his presidency. Is it the same idea? In other words, you can save a lot of money if you can pay off high interest rate bonds with a lower. Is that part of the idea, is to be able to make that kind of a...
Sounds like the treasurer's question.
not to put myself in Bill Clinton's shoes, but... The whole idea behind refunding is to take advantage of lower interest rates. Obviously, we issue bonds and been issuing them over time for years, and when we commit ourselves to issuing bonds, we're locked into interest rates. As markets change and interest rates drop, it's at points, just like you when you own a house, it's prudent to refinance yourself and take advantage of that. So that's, in essence, what we're doing with refunding.
Great. Senator Metzger.
Yeah, just can you give me an example, maybe Chuck, on a forward current refunding, a short term, can you just give me an example of one of those types of bonds?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, a forward current refunding is used when a particular bond issue cannot do an advance refunding. Okay, well,
thank you for explaining that.
Thank you. That's it.
Next question is, what does that mean?
So far, we haven't gotten anywhere with that. But
that's why I brought him up, Mr. Chair.
There are certain categories of bonds that are called private activity bonds that are generally cannot advance refund a private activity bond. Other types of bonds, governmental purpose bonds, you can advance refund those bonds. But here's an example. Let's suppose that interest rates dropped significantly, and you had a private activity bond, and the state has considerable amount of these outstanding, that came due in, say, 6 months.
Can you give me an example of a private activity bond?
A private activity bond might be an energy bond. It could be all our housing bonds are private activity bonds. So they're used by private people or private parties. Okay. So 6 months from now, we would be able to... Let's say we had a bond that was either callable 6 months from now, interest rates drop sharply today, we would say this would be an ideal opportunity to do a forward current refunding. We could enter into an agreement today to refund those bonds 6 months from now based on today's interest rates plus a premium paid for the six-month period. The state would wind up by being able to do refund at that time and save substantial amounts of money.
Thank you.
You might be able to then lock in that lower interest rate, assuming that it might go up in that 6 months. Is that kind of the thought? Or?
Mr. Chair, the rate is locked in today.
At that point,
that's
yeah,
correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Any further questions? Okay. We thank you very much.
Thank you.
Patrick, is that it on the sign-up?
No, there was also Mr. Ken Armstrong who signed up to testify.
Okay. Ken, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ken Armstrong. I'm here today representing Seattle Northwest Securities Corporation. We were essentially the sponsors or the authors of the amendment in Section 2 of the bill that deals with the advance refunding portion of it. Basically, it was a technical issue that we saw as being a problem as underwriters that needed to be addressed in order to get out of a problem that resulted from when the school guarantee program was established. There ended up being some problems with dates for when payments were required to be made to a paying agent, and districts would find themselves in a circumstance if they were going to make the payment. If the payment was due on December 15th, and this is probably giving you way more detail than you want to know, the payment to the paying agent had to be made on November 15th. That resulted in a circumstance where districts didn't have a lot of money in hand because of when property taxes are due and so forth. And so the technical fix that we're looking for here is to extend out that date when the payments need to be made in order to allow districts to take advantage of the school guarantee program, because statute does prohibit currently the extension of the period of the bond issue. So the effect of the amendment is to extend out that period so that districts can take advantage of the refunding under the school guarantee program. We had a separate bill that we were introducing under this issue when this issue came forward in the form of House Bill 2122. We thought it probably made sense to save the committee and everyone else time, amend it together. The treasurer was amenable to it, and so we're asking your consideration for that issue.
Sure did have the right relating clause, didn't it?
Yes, it does.
Any questions?
I just know he's amenable to amendable.
He's amenable. Ken, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's it.
No other justifiers.
Okay, no additional. Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2122.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2122 to the floor with a due pass.
Vice Chair Metzgers, move House Bill 2122 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call a roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2122 has been declared passed. Will be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Anyone want to carry it?
I can take it in combination if you
want. You
want
to do a combination?
I'm going to back to back. And
right. Okay. Close the work session on House Bill 2122 and open a public hearing, possible work session on Senate Bill 640.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 640 deletes provision allowing the Oregon Department of Transportation to contract with other road authorities for issuance of continuous operation variance permits. Background, road authorities may issue variance permits to allow overdimensional vehicles to be operated under specified conditions. Road authorities consider a number of factors in determining whether particular trucks can safely operate on a road, including whether the vehicle can maintain its lane of travel, whether it can maintain its speed on grades, whether there are turnouts or road structures to allow safe passing, and whether the road structure can handle the truck size. House Bill 2635B, enacted by the 1999 Oregon Legislative Assembly, required ODOT in consultation with local governments to develop a variance permit system under which a person could obtain an annual continuous operating permit for an overdimensional vehicle. The permit was designed to allow operation on state highways and all local jurisdiction roads along designated routes. House Bill 2635B was designed to provide additional access to trucking companies that had previously experienced difficulty in obtaining permits. Further, House Bill 2635B required ODOT to honor the size and weight restrictions established by any road authority. Trucking companies contend that it has been difficult to comply with the varying size and weight restrictions and varying permit fee levels established since the passage of House Bill 2635B, and the standards developed by counties have, in fact, thus far lacked uniformity. There is no revenue impact issued, but there is a fiscal impact to counties totaling $255,000 during the 2001 and 2003 biennium, and $340,000 during the 2003 to 2005 biennium. And I don't have the sign-up sheet, but I can imagine that I'll go get it in a second. That Mr.
Right.
D. Bridges from the Oregon
Forest
Products Association.
All right, you want to come on up?
Association would like to testify.
That's a good guess, Mr. Chair.
This was one of our great ideas that went astray. Okay.
I don't have any written testimony, so let me just kind of wing this. For the record, Dee Bridges, the Oregon Forest Products Transportation Association. With me today is Leon Fisher from Celeste Trucking Company. Leon is a former chair of OFPTA. Last session, Patrick mentioned, House Bill 2635 was passed. It created a one-stop shop for overdimensional permits. And a great idea. The devil got to be in the details. There was a whole series of meetings that were set up over a period of a year or a year and a half. And from those meetings resulted the implementation of the bill. What happened caused us a difficulty with it was that 25 of the 36 counties reverted to a 1948 law that had a maximum of 50 feet for a log truck, or for a truck. Every log truck in the state is longer than 50 feet. So what this required was that we'd have to have a county permit, a state permit, and a county permit for every county that our log trucks operated in. So we thought what we should do is have the state be in the business of determining which of these permits should be issued and which configurations or combinations of vehicles required a permit. So Senate Bill 640 was an attempt to send that back to the state. The state would then consult with each of the counties to try to determine what roads in their counties actually required the shorter permits or wouldn't be eligible for overdimensional permits, better way of saying that, and ask that this bill be introduced. And we subsequently knew we were going to run into a lot of opposition with it, and subsequently came up with what we have been referring to as maybe a better mousetrap. And we had that introduced over on the House side. And all that does is make 60-foot trucks legal, and or a 65-foot stinger-steered pole trailer, which is actually a log truck, legal. The reason for that is because they track nicely, whereas some other 60-foot stinger-steered vehicles or combinations don't track nicely. House Bill 3662. It came out, I think, Friday. We would still, on reflection, that has not received unanimous support either. I think it's probably the more likely of the two to move. If it doesn't move, we want this one to move. So I'm here today to actually recommend that the bill do move. It does have some problems with it. That when it came out of LC, it didn't come out the way it was intended to. The first problem is right at it's in the bill summary where it says, the summary is deletes provision allowing Department of Transportation to contract with other road authorities for issuance of continuous operation variance permits, and that was not our intent. Right. There are four contractors right now. There's OTA is a contractor, a Safe Workplace, those are two private entities, and then Marion County and Lane County are contractors. We have no problem with them continuing to be contractors or some other entity also being added to that list. So that part was not our intent. The bill needs to be corrected, in mm-hmm. my view, for that. Okay. The idea of the bill was just simply that the state would be kind of the final arbiter of what roads were required to have a permit. There are some roads in each county, probably every county, that these overdimensional permits vehicles just don't belong on. And we have no problem with the county restricting those. It's just that we don't want to have to deal with 36 road authorities determining their own interpretation of what is a road that requires this permit and what doesn't. So that was the reason for the bill. And as I said, I would like to have the bill amended to do what it was really intended to do, get it over to the House side because of the time limitations here,
And then we are working with the counties to come up with an equitable solution that we can all agree with. But frankly, I don't know whether that's this one or it's the House bill that's over there. So we'd like to get this over there so we got both bills in one place and go with it from there.
Well, Dee, rather than proceeding with a hearing, I mean, I think the wisest thing for us to do right now is have you guys get together with us and see if we can come up with amendments that will clarify the bill. Because I believe there is a problem out there. I've observed it in one of my counties, and it was a great idea at the time. But I do think we need to do something to address the problem of non-uniformity and the fact that some of the decisions, to me, appear to be rather arbitrary. And so hopefully we can arrive at that.
Well, there's one county, for example, that requires, everybody went into this, I think, in a good faith effort. It's just that the result of it all came out to where one kind of an unworkable situation, in our view, where there's at least one county in the state that has maybe 10% of their roads that require special kind of attention, and so they went back to the 50-foot for 100% of the roads. Well, 90% of the roads it isn't a problem on, and it just seemed to me the wrong approach to try to solve that problem.
You guys are fine. All right, Patrick, we have some other folks signed up, I understand, representing counties. And might want to have, if they want to come forward at this point, that would be fine. At least give us an opinion of whether you think there's a problem or not. Might be informative for the committee. Welcome. I'll let you two decide who's going to go first and state your name for the record and proceed.
Chairman George, members of the committee, I'm John O'Shell with the Association of Oregon Counties. With me today is Jan Shields, who manages the Permit Center with Marion County, in case you have any questions. To answer your first question, is there a problem with inconsistency amongst the counties? Yes, there is. Counties certainly acknowledge that, would like to be working on the problem to solve it. Related to this bill doesn't solve that. Regardless of intentions, what it says is that, gee, there's four people issuing annual permits, and let's eliminate two of them who happen to be the county agencies and just do the private. That's kind of a total different issue, has nothing to do with who issues. Because regardless of who issues it, whether it be the counties or the state, how those routes are designated through a process of the counties working with ODOT. So that process exists regardless of who issues the permit. This doesn't do it. The other thing that is in here and hasn't been mentioned in the summary or anything, this thing also has a radical change in the fee structure, which hasn't been mentioned, and that is a problem. Right now, the fee that is collected is the amount is set by the state at $8 per jurisdiction receiving a permit. Depending on who's issuing the permit and where, that money does get distributed different ways. That is set by administrative rule by ODOT. They're in the process of going through an administrative rule revision to consider how that is going to happen again. So that's in process to determine if that's fair and equitable as far as how it's distributed. There's the issue of how much goes to ODOT, who provides services for all permits, regardless of who issues them. There's the amount of money that goes to the issuing agency, whether it be the county or the private. And then there's the money that has to go back to the county for the processes they need to do to determine what routes are safe. And in their process, they'll evolve that. There does need to be a lot of work done yet on how to get that consistency. It is an extremely difficult one. Because candidly, whenever you talk to anyone, whether it be the people driving the trucks or the people issuing the permits, no one wants to put some nice, tight little numbers on what it should be. And the final analysis, both sides want it to be a judgment call, and we've got to figure out how to do that more uniformly. It's going to be tough. It's going to be hard. The counties want to do it, too. It's just how to get there. And we're in the middle of a process. This thing started up a year ago. There was a bunch of people that basically did not work the permit programs before. Candidly, there were a lot of counties out there working with a no harm, no foul. No one was complaining. They didn't want to get in the permit business. With 2635 last year, we had to get in the permit business. So we had a bunch of people who had not been in the permit business having to figure out how to do that. A lot of those counties that hadn't received money in the past and are receiving it now has spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to do it. Quick summary. Problems identified, 640 doesn't. doesn't even go there for solving those problems. Whether or not it wants to be a legislative solution or a working solution in the interim, I think we'll probably work that out over on the House side, Bill, and see where that goes. It may make it back to you guys for now, but I think that's probably the bill that the argument needs to be had, is whether it should be legislative or continued administrative process. Thank you.
Okay, great. John, I think what I'll ask you to do, though, is to provide for us what you think it would take to correct the concerns that the truckers have and the counties now have, along with ODOT, and we'll at least get that framework ready to go, depending on what happens with the other bill, just to have it moving forward. I think that will be where I will handle this.
And I don't have a tight answer to that. I've asked Bob Russell and Dee Bridges to attend the monthly meeting of the Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors a week from Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that out of that we at least come out of a work group that can develop rather soon at least a work plan on how to get to the answer.
Right.
At this point, I'm still hearing a wide range of opinions of the best way to deal with it. I think amongst the counties, it's clear that we recognize that this length that Dee Bridges is proposing is very valid for the vast majority of our roads. It's how to deal with the problem ones, so that some poor trucker doesn't end up stuck at the end of a road and having to back out because he's too illegal to go into an unsafe area.
If he's any kind of a tracker, trucker, he can back it. No, not a problem.
Yeah, but, you know.
I've been there, though. I can remember taking a low bed into the hills of Yamhill County and beginning to wonder if I was ever going to come back or not.
Yeah. Senator George, they can back very well, as you say, but they don't like it.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, well, we'll just put this bill on hold then and wait till we hear from this group. And if the House bill moves, we're perfectly happy with it.
Okay.
Great, okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 640. And what we're going to do right now is open an information meeting. Staff is going to give a presentation on the flat fee in Oregon. So we'll open that at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Senator George had asked me to give a brief overview of flat fees in Oregon, what they are, how they're utilized, and their significance, and also the flat fee study and how it's used to assist in the determination of the appropriate level of flat fees, which in turn impacts the legislature, which has to make the determination of what the appropriate level is under the flat fee system. And that ties into Senate Bill 697, which will follow my brief overview. First of all, we're well cognizant of the truck tax system in the state of Oregon, with the weight mile tax providing the vast majority of the revenues from the motor carrier industry. It's a graduated fee based on the weight of the vehicle and the miles traveled in Oregon. However, there is a monthly fixed fee which is offered to some motor carriers. The fixed fee does not vary with usage, and it's paid by certain motor carriers based on the commodities that they haul, and it's paid in lieu of the weight mile taxes. Now, the basics of the flat fee system is that it was designed to reduce record-keeping requirements for selected segments of the trucking industry. For example, the log truckers who are constantly hopping, or at least the small mom-and-pop log truckers historically hopping on and off private logging roads, in which case it's very difficult because, as you know, when you're reporting weight mile taxes, you only report the miles that you actually travel on Oregon roadways. So in the event that you're on a private road, you should not be counting those miles. So as you hop on and off those roads, it becomes an onerous burden to comply with the system. At least historically, that's how it was framed. Motor carriers that may use flat fee options roughly fall into three categories: the log truckers, that includes the poles and the peeler cores and the pilings, and also the sand and gravel truckers, which include things like rock and dirt debris cinders and asphaltic concrete mix, et cetera, and then the wood chip haulers, which includes the sawdust and the bark dust and the hog fuel and shavings. And it's worth noting that the flat fee is, in fact, an option to both Oregon-based carriers and foreign carriers, so there's no discrimination with regard to the application of the flat fee in Oregon. Now, with regard to the rates, it's set based on an annual fee per 100 pounds of, I believe, gross vehicle operating weight. And so, for example, with log carriers with a $5.55 annual fee per 100 pounds, that works out to approximately $4,440 for an 80,000-pound truck operating in the state of Oregon. Of course, that would be broken out into 12, you know, equal fixed payments that would not vary depending upon the actual miles traveled by the log trucker in the state of Oregon. There is a theoretical justification for the flat fees, as briefly described before, which is that it is designed to reduce the record keeping requirements for the small companies that historically had operated within these segments of the trucking industry. There was a weight mile tax study that showed the compliance costs for small operators were much higher as a percent of total tax liability relative to the larger trucking companies. In fact, the weight mile tax study found that compliance costs for small operators were roughly 8% of total tax liability, which is quite significant. And so the flat fee was designed to reduce the burden for these small truckers that are operating commonly on private roads and hopping on back and forth. And once again, it was not designed to provide any sort of special tax exemption, though arguments have been made in the legal venue and then also in the legislature here that, in fact, it is resulting in a tax reduction for the flat fee payers. And it is worth noting that there is a divorce of the cost responsibility concept when you consider flat fee, because once again, it's not tied directly to the costs that are imposed on the system by the flat fee carrier. It is an approximation of use, and the flat fee rate is supposed to be adjusted upward or downward based on the findings of the flat fee study. But within the flat fee groups, of course, the high mileage members of the industry are getting a tax reduction on a per mile basis, and then the low mileage carriers would, of course, be picking up the tab for the high mileage carriers in that sense. There have been a number of flat fee studies conducted between 1986 and I believe actually 2000 is the most recent study. And in fact, these flat fee studies are mandated by statute. The 1989 Oregon Legislative Assembly requires ODOT to review the flat fee rates every 2 years and recommended rate adjustments to the Oregon Legislature. And the way the study basically works is that data are compiled and two calculations are made. The first is what was actually paid under the flat fee system and what should have been paid under the weight mile tax system. And by comparing those two, you can calculate an over or under payment. Now, traditionally, flat fee rates have been adjusted as weight mile tax rates were adjusted or as gas taxes were increased. However, the 1999 legislature did break with this longstanding tradition, and that's worthy of note. Now, with regard to conducting the flat fee study, and this gets into our Senate Bill 697, basically, tax reports from the flat fee payers are keyed into a highway use database. Several hundred lines of the data is taken from this database and used as a study sample. And that, of course, is applied to the population of the database. The data is later sorted into 2,000-pound increments, and there are assumptions concerning configuration that are made to determine the different declared weights at which we could expect these flat fee pairs to operate. In fact, the hard and fast rule is that 50% of the operations would be at an empty and decked position, so that reduces the declared operating weight, or declared weight at which they would report weight mile taxes. That has a significant impact on the study. Once again, the flat fees are summed and weight mile taxes are calculated and the two data points are compared. Now, when you take the flat fee reports, and I think that Representative ODOT may actually bring one of these reports forward, you have two lines, or you have two boxes there for the number of miles that you travel in the state of Oregon. One is the total miles traveled in the state of Oregon, and then secondly, the total miles of travel on Oregon roadways. And so I think there's a serious question as to whether or not the appropriate mileage data is entered into the database, because the important number when calculating the weight mile tax liability for comparative purposes is not the total miles traveled in the state of Oregon, but instead the miles that are traveled on the Oregon roadway system, because the private road miles and off-road miles are all tax exempt. So there are some potential problems with the study that have been noted by some economists, and that is that to a certain degree, the data that is collected through the flat fee report is taken at face value from the forms and without survey follow-up. Through 1995, there were surveys issued. 97, I believe there was a survey, and I don't know the extent to which it was actually utilized. I think it was abandoned at some point for some problems that they had perceived with the outcome of the survey, and ODOT could probably provide a good clarifying point here. So the miles that are noted in the tax report may or may not be accurate. With the weight mile tax reports, they're, I think, deemed to be highly accurate because, first of all, it is incumbent upon the motor carrier to report the accurate mileage because there's a real chance that he may be audited. And secondly, his tax payments are tied to the number of miles that he's reporting. Now, in the case of the flat fee, you know, neither of those necessarily are the case, and my understanding is from motor carriers is that when they do audit the flat fee payers, that it's a very messy procedure because of the lack of filing that's done and the precision with which the information is kept. And that makes sense because there's really no strong incentive or enforcement mechanism for them to provide the data with any degree of accuracy. And so the miles noted in the tax report and then input into the database, I think, may or may not be accurate. And I think this point was brought out to a certain degree after the 1997 study, I believe it was. Once again, ODOT can clarify, but the Oregon Forest Products Transportation Association, the gentleman who worked there, I believe, before Dee Bridges, had noted that he thought that that was an incorrect assumption to just take all the data at face value and assume that 100% of the miles were done on Oregon roads. And so a follow-up survey was done by the Motor Carriers Transportation Division, and I believe the finding was that something more like 80 or 82% of the miles should have been considered taxable. I know historically the number was somewhere around 90% in the 95 and pre-95 studies at ODOT. And that's a very important part of the study, is determining what should actually be counted. And then once again, the assumptions concerning configuration, you know, the percentage that are loaded and or unloaded and decked are also very important, because if you're unloaded and decked, you're declaring at a different weight than if you're fully loaded. And so I think that the ire was raised to a certain extent, and I'll skip over the woodchip carriage, because you can see that the payment as compared to liability as calculated in the study are quite close all throughout. But log carriers, there was a general shift in methodology between 1995 and 1997, and you know, virtually overnight you show a significant underpayment of something on the order of 30 or 40% there, and it only got worse as time went by, or at least immediately in the following years from 1998. And those findings were called into question by the motor carrier industry, and then I think their suspicions were, at least to some extent, confirmed by the follow-up survey that was provided. So I think, at the very least, there's some question here as to the degree of accuracy in the study. I've heard some arguments both ways, that, in fact, it's being done correctly and perhaps it hasn't, but I don't think that there's clarity there as far as how accurate it is. Once again, sand and gravel carriage, you see a similar pattern. In 97, it got bad, and 98, it got really bad. As far as the variance between the liability and payment. And, of course, if the payment is slumping far below the liability, then there's an implication that the tax rate should be increased to capture that additional cost that's being imposed on the road system. And so the decision points appear to be, based on my analysis, the following four questions. Is there a problem with the study, or is in fact, the study being done correctly? If there is a problem with the study, how can the study be improved? Thirdly, how should the study be implemented? Once again, I noted that up through 99, it traditionally was implemented with the findings of a highway cost allocation study, or with increases in reductions or increases in the fuel tax. But once again, in 1999, there was no adjustment. And then there has been some discussion lately provided by some that would indicate that there's an interest in abandoning the flat fee system altogether. And I guess the thought there is that it's not really serving its originally intended purpose, you know, the small mom-and-pop operator. And the benefits aren't necessarily there, and there's the separation between true cost responsibility and what's actually occurring. And then there's obviously some other issues with regard to an American Trucking Association lawsuit and other complications that are resulting because of the flat fee system and some other subsidies that are in place. And so I think that's just the basic framework of discussion for the 697. And the idea, I think, when we originally put this together was just to get the concept out there and then have the discussion and then move beyond that with some sort of, you know, technical assistance to make sure that it addresses the correct points. But that's the basics of the issue.
Okay. I think it is an important issue that the very concept of feeding trucks in the state is based on the idea of fairness, and that it is accountability for the use or wear of the road that was provided or done. So it does become a little bit disturbing when you see the numbers start to spread like the last couple of carriers.
And the point that I was making to a certain degree, Mr. Chairman, was are the numbers spreading because there is this disparity, and in fact, perhaps an adjustment should be made, or the system could be considered, there could be consideration of abandoning the system, or is the spread the result of changes in the methodology of the study that may or may not be accurate? And so.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead at this time and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 697. Patrick, describe the bill for us, and we'll have some folks tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 697 requires the Oregon Department of Transportation, as part of its biennial review of flat fee rates, to distribute questionnaires to trucking companies in order to determine the percentage of total miles traveled that occur on Oregon highways, the percentage of total miles traveled carrying a full load, and the number of axles used for all vehicles operating at a combined weight that exceeds 80,000 pounds. It requires the Legislative Assembly to make adjustments to flat fee rates in order to ensure that flat fee paying carriers would pay as much as they would if they had reported taxes under the weight mile tax system. And we do have Mr. D. Bridges of the Oregon Forest Products Transportation Association, Leon Fisher of Celeste Trucking signed up to testify once again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I do have written testimony on this one, and that's what's coming around today. Again, for the record, I'm Dee Bridges, the Oregon Forest Products Transportation Association. With me today, again, is Leon Fisher of Celeste Trucking and Independence. Attached to my written testimony is a letter from Leon's office manager that I think you'll find interesting. She actually works with this stuff every day and is, frankly, a lot more cognizant of all of the ramifications of it than I am. Leon is here today to answer any technical questions that you might have. OFPTA is an association of some 350 members in the business of hauling logs, chips, plywood, lumber, and other forest products. Many of our members pay flat fees. Many of those members are mom-and-pop business, one truck owner-operated. In fact, more than 85% of our members own fewer than five trucks. They work very hard, and they're probably not, frankly, real good at bookkeeping. They don't keep very accurate numbers regarding loaded versus unloaded miles or miles driven on private roads each day, because there's really no apparent incentive for them to do so, since they're going to pay a flat fee anyhow. The methodology ODOT used to do their flat fee study this year simply took lines out of a computer and assumed that they were accurate. They weren't. I have no doubt that they used statistically valid random sampling methods, and I have no doubt that the arithmetic is correct. But if the assumptions going in are wrong, the answers that you get are going to be wrong, kind of garbage in, garbage out. That's nobody's fault but ours, the industry. But again, recognize that most of the people who are submitting these reports are not awfully sophisticated when it comes to record keeping. They're truck drivers. Drivers simply do not do a good job of record keeping when they don't need to in order to pay their taxes. I said that before. I've included a copy of an ODOT form that truckers use to pay flat fees. That's on the last page there. I've shown two examples of how the report might be filled out. Example A is the way I would fill it out. I have an accounting background, and that's the way I would do it. I think probably example A is how ODOT thinks truckers fill their report out, or at least how they arrive at the numbers that they put down on their report. More accurately, in reality, probably most log truckers fill out the form the way I've shown it in example B. And I have personal anecdotal knowledge of many, many of our members who simply put, for Oregon taxable miles, the total miles. Column 5 and 6 are real easy. They're just beginning and ending odometer readings. Column 7 is just subtract one from the other and put down the total miles. However, for column 8, you first got to figure out how many loaded miles you traveled that month and enter it for 80,000 pounds, which is the typical weight for a log truck loaded, and then enter the unloaded miles for 46,000 pounds, again, typical for a log truck. Then you take each of those numbers and multiply them by a factor arrived at by determining the percentage of total miles you traveled on private roads. It's a little complicated, and I think you begin to see the problem with assuming that these miles are reported accurately. It isn't a real easy form to fill out accurately. Probably a great deal could be done to improve the reporting if the form were designed differently, where you tell people to put down your loaded miles here and your unloaded miles here, and then multiply those times your off-road percentage or on-highway percentage. Nowhere in the instructions, even on the front or the back of the report, does it tell you to do that. It's just assumed that they know how to do that, and in some cases I'm sure they do, but also in many, many cases, and I would submit probably the majority of the cases, they don't. And I've talked to some pretty sophisticated operators who for years just simply put down total miles for Oregon taxable miles. ODOT assumes that those in their study, they assumed that those numbers are correct. They assume that only 50% of the miles are unloaded, even though everyone in the log trucking business knows that you travel more unloaded miles than loaded in most cases. And Leon can talk to that more accurately than I can, but kind of typically, you got a log truck driver that lives at home. He takes his truck home with him at night. He comes back and he goes into the woods and he picks up his load and he delivers it to a mill, and he may do that two or three times a day, and then he goes back home again. And as the timber supply continues to diminish, most of the logging done in Oregon today is done on private property. So you're having to travel farther and farther and farther to get to that load. The number of unloaded miles tends to be increasing, I believe. I've heard numbers of 60-40, 60% unloaded, 40% loaded. It could be worse than that, and I think it will continue to get worse than that. Yet, ODOT, in their methodology, assumed 50%. No reflection on them. They probably didn't know the...
Mm-hmm.
The
thank you, Mr. Chair. Wouldn't that be skewed? There's also more backhauls in today's log hauling than there used to be, so wouldn't that, you'd have to account for that too? Or do most, well, I would think flat rate people also do backhauls as well, so.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Messer, you are correct. There are some operators that have backhauls, and if that is the case, that number, you're right, absolutely does get skewed. I think there are a lot fewer of those in numbers and probably in total volume of logs moved than there are the other kind that go out empty and come back full. But that is a valid point. And I don't know how to factor it into it. It's the only way to factor it into it is kind of what the bill suggests. You go talk to people and find out what their situation is. It is almost impossible to under-report Oregon taxable miles on that form. The only way you'd underreport it is if you wanted to cheat. And why you'd want to cheat, I don't know, because you can pay a flat fee anyhow. But it is real, real easy to overreport Oregon taxable miles. The most worst example of that is somebody who just puts down the total number of miles in Oregon taxable miles as they had in total taxable miles. And in fact, in the summary, the executive summary of the flat fee study, it says under methodology, it says Oregon miles reported, and then in parentheses they say total miles reported if Oregon miles are not indicated on the report. I think in a lot of cases probably people don't even fill out column 8. They just fill out column number 7. And in that case, according to this, ODOT used the total Oregon miles. And if they did that, they made a mistake, and a pretty big mistake. The combination of all of this resulted in a deeply flawed flat fee study that is so out of whack it ought to be discarded. OFPTA and others asked to be included in the oversight of this study, and we were refused. I believe probably if we were, if they would have allowed us to participate, we would have been able to point out the errors of where they were going with these things, and we probably wouldn't have that problem. Their study shows that log trucks are underpaying taxes by 27%, I think is the number they used. Interestingly enough, the last study they did only showed us underpaying by 17%. And in an intervening period, there's been a reduction in weight mile taxes. So how the weight mile taxes can be reduced, yet our underpayment increases, kind of defies logic in my mind. Also on that same study, you compare the two, they had CHIPS underpaying by something in the neighborhood of 50% 2 years ago, and the current one has them overpaying by 50%. So there's something wrong there, too, although there are a very small number of CHIP payers, and that could be explained in that. But to me, it looks suspicious. Senate Bill 697 prescribes a method of doing flat studies that is far superior to the methodology used this year by ODOT. We urge its passage. Except that we think that the word shall on line 18 should be replaced with may. We don't think one legislature can bind another. And further, when ODOT messes up a study as badly as they did this one, we don't think the legislature ought to be bound to accept bad information and adjust rates accordingly.
Okay. Any questions? Senator Mansford?
Yeah, thank you. Just using an assumption of the difficulties in this and some of the accuracy of the information or inaccuracy therein, you know, ODOT has the ability to get rid of this flat fee and put everybody on weight miles. Wouldn't that solve all the problems that you indicated? Just not even have to go worry about trying to figure out these problems and just put everybody on weight mile?
That is an approach that's been suggested, and I know that ODOT would prefer that we do that, or I've heard that they do. I don't think that's a good deal. 90% of our people, as I said, are mom and pops. The law was designed in 1949 to address those people, to make their record keeping easier. I think the reason for that law exists just as much today as it did then. It does take a lot of effort to accurately fill out a weight mile report. And while ODOT has, and they still cite an OAR that says that they're required to keep the same records, I guess I'm here to sort of fess up that really doesn't happen. I think most of our mom and pops, they enter their total miles. They know that if they ever do get audited down the road sometime, which odds are they're not going to be, but if they do get audited, they'll go back and on the back of an envelope make a good faith effort of applying what they know kind of intuitively and through their experience are loaded, unloaded mile percentages and off-road versus highway miles percentages, and they'll make those records. So.
Thank you, sir.
You're right. Terry, answer questions.
Okay. Patrick, who else would sign that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next testifier is Mr. Mike Marsh of the Oregon Department of Transportation.
Mike, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Marsh from the Department of Transportation, just here to make a few comments about Senate Bill 697. Patrick and the other testifiers have discussed the purpose of the bill. Basically, what it would do is change the process a little bit and require some additional work by the motor carrier audit program. Bottom line is that we're already statutory mandated to do the flat fee study. It would require the audit staff to analyze the tax report information that's been elected or done by those folks that have elected to do a flat fee approach. We're trying to right now look at the miles that are involved and are reported by these carriers, compute their tax as if they have been under the weight mile tax approach and make the comparison. It goes to the Department of Administrative Services and to the highway cost allocation process. What the bill would say is that we have to do the process of sending the questionnaires, conducting interviews, verifying the percentage of Oregon miles that are traveled, the percentage of fully loaded versus empty miles, and the number of axles per vehicle for those 80,000 pounds and more. We do a process now, which we've done the last 2 years, of going through reports and selecting out the information from those reports. In the last two studies, we've done it a little bit differently each time. First time was a randomly selected process of going back to the carriers themselves and validating the information. The second time was randomly selected on a broader basis, looking at the carrier information on the reports. So we already do a significant amount of work on this. It would just require that we do a full interviewing process, a full survey process. I don't think we're necessarily opposed to the bill. What we're just trying to communicate is it starts to increase the amount of work done for each one of these, and you get to a point where one starts to wonder if, when you're doing that much work, if it isn't approximating the weight mile tax process anyway, and whether there's a use to the flat fee program when you're getting to that much requirement. As was mentioned, there's already an administrative rule on the books saying that there should be these records kept, and it's clear that the records are not being kept. We can make estimates and do the process of surveying, but if folks are always estimating, it makes it difficult to make sure that you're coming up with accurate information anyway. The other point I wanted to make sure we make clear is that if we put into the statute an exact process when we're dealing with statistics, it gets to be a little bit difficult to go back and make adjustments if we want to say that we're going to do it just a little bit differently in the future because we have better data or better approaches. It gets difficult to put technical processes actually in the statute. So if after the discussion, the flat fee function continues, and the sense of the committee is that they'd like to see this specific process done, we would probably suggest, if it was possible, go with legislative intent to say this is the intent that we do this kind of survey, and we take that legislative intent and operate with it, and maybe it could be changed next time if we have more and better statistical tools. The other piece is also looking at other kinds of adjustments that might be possible here. As was mentioned, the original intent was to deal with those folks who have, using the phrase mom-and-pop truckers, who have a one or two trucks in their fleet. So it really is just a smaller amount of asset they're dealing with, less amount of business work that they're going through. If the intent was for that purpose, maybe the idea would be to cut flat fee back to that kind of operation instead of allowing for the broader operations to make use of this. Those are some options that the committee can have, and we're open to discussion about either the current process or as you'd like to look at alternatives.
Senator Messonnier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We heard testimony that the truckers were not involved in the advisory committee to this study. I'm wondering why.
Mr. Chair and Senator Messonnier, they were involved the last time, and what we tried to do is fully involve them last time, go through an educational process to say what was going on, to communicate what is in the reports that we have, to make sure there was full understanding the last time. This time the feeling was that we'd fully gone through all that information. We'd done an educational process with both the trucking community as well as our motor carrier transportation division going out and getting information out about that. Nothing then changed in terms of the paperwork. There had been a pretty good educational process to say it's worthwhile to take a few minutes to fill it out and give it your best shot. Instead of prior to that, there was a feeling that what's the value of putting any time into it because it didn't relate to anything. We tried to fully educate about that subject, have that information out there so that good forms could be filled out. And then we used the same process of reports, same reports were used this last time. And so the feeling was there wasn't a value in having more discussion about it. It went to the Motor Carrier Advisory Committee to communicate what was happening. So we felt like we had reasonable communication about what happened and that it wasn't a reason to have more full discussion.
Mr. Chair, follow up. I'm not concerned about education as I'm concerned about, obviously there were some assumptions made And I would think that's where it would be a good check to have people from the industry to verify those assumptions, recognizing that you had had an had communication with them prior, but also times change, patterns change, distance of operation change, those kind of things. So I'm a little surprised that they weren't included just as the Transportation Advisory Committee to the study.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mesley, we did involve the Motor Carrier Transportation Advisory Committee and involve and discuss where things were going. We didn't have a separate group, though. We did have the study review team of the Highway Cost Allocation Study where there's brief discussion about it. We can have, I'm not averse to having more discussion of these kind of things with these groups. The difficulty is that the opportunities and data is not that significant. The information you have to work with is not going to be perfect data in any case, and so the process that you use is going to be debatable no matter what occurs, which is one of the challenges of dealing with the flat fee function in general. No matter what you do, when you're dealing with folks who are making gross estimates about how things are going, when there isn't detail kept about it, is going to result in not precise information. But I hear what the Senator is saying, and depending on how things come out with the committee, we're happy to have more discussion. The challenge is how to get better information tracked and reported.
Chair, more follow-up, please. The graphs that were presented by our staff member, are these ODOT graphs, or were they developed by the department?
I didn't see these. Senator Meschley was taken out of, was taken directly out of the ODOT reports. And so in each flat fee study, and I'll give this to you in just a second,
okay.
Mr. Marsh, in each ODOT flat fee study, they calculate both the actual collections from the flat fee payers and then what they would have paid or what their full responsibility was under the weight mile tax system. And so all I simply did was input those numbers into a spreadsheet and generate these graphs. So they're all ODOT generated numbers.
Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm.
Again, when I see the variance in these graphs, and I apologize if you haven't seen them before, but it indicates to me that there very possibly could have been some error in the assumptions made in doing the study, which would indicate that maybe we did need more input.
Senator Messerly, I was just going to ask Mike that question, so maybe I'll tag on with you here. And Mike, my understanding is that prior from 1995 back, and if you look at that, for example, log carriers, the graph right there,
mm-hmm.
Okay, no page number on that, but log carriers, their payment was exceeding their liability, established liability. But I understand that from 95 back, they were filling out a questionnaire and participating in the process. Is that correct? Is that, you weren't there then, but...
Correct. Mr. Chair, as I understand it, there was a survey process after each one in that time period. There was also a survey after the one in 97.
Well, there was one in 97.
But was the said 97, I just wanted to make sure I understood
there was a relationship.
And once again, maybe motor carriers could provide the clarification here. I thought that the 97 survey at some point was discarded because there were some...
There were two elements to the one in 97, and actually I should refer to, depends on, we're looking at data here that says 97 and 98. The one I'm referring to after the 98 study, which was done on 97 data, that's the one where we had a survey that was done afterwards to do a very quick kind of connection to see what was out there, to see if we could validate what was found. And as Patrick is alluding to, there was concern expressed by the results of that survey, and so the survey adjusted the final results. That was a 98 study on the basis of 97 data. If that answers Patrick's question. The other thing I wanted to mention briefly is in prior testimony, there was a comment made that how could the amount possibly go up for additional liability here in 2000 on the basis of 99 data, and that 99 data was calculated and actually existed before the weight mile tax went down in September of 99. So when we're talking about information that relates, or September of 2000, when we're talking about that 1999 data, it occurred before the reduction in weight mile tax. So that's one reason why 99 data can be up from the prior 97 study.
Chair.
Senator Messley.
But again, my concern is that with sand and gravel carriers, it went up significantly in 98, then dropped down significantly, and the gap narrowed significantly for the year 2000. And I guess I'd be, and I apologize, this is unfair to put you on the spot when you first look at the graph, but I think at some future time I'd like an explanation from your perspective of why that, why the study shows that, and if, and in fact, this is an accurate graph, in your opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to have more discussion about the whys and wherefores of what is shown there. I think the bottom line to the whole study process, though, is that you are working on the basis of estimates on the part of the folks who you're surveying, and you're not working with solid data in any case. So it's difficult to come up with what is the bottom line connection to make a strong connection to what the reality is. But at the same time, I'd be happy to get a little more information to be able to talk to you about trends and what we're seeing.
I just wanted to ask one, Mr. Chairman, if it's okay. I just wanted to ask one last question, and that was that I wasn't clear because the there was a follow-up survey that was issued by, it was sort of a much smaller survey that was issued by the Motor Carriers Transportation Division, either the 97 or the 98 study, and I get confused between those two studies. I know one kind of followed on to the other, but when that occurred, my understanding was that I don't know if the 98 study reflects the findings of that smaller survey or what, but I'd like to understand that better.
Greg Delpani, for the record.
Greg knows.
You may regret you asked me to the table. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Greg Delpani, Deputy Director of the Motor Carrier Transportation Division. The flat fee study released in 1999, which was the 1998 flat fee study, looked at 1997 data. And talking about that study reflects a change in process as compared to all previous flat fee studies. All prior flat fee studies did include a survey. However, they did include an erroneous assumption.
Did you say that again?
They did include an erroneous assumption, okay, which I'll describe. Motor carriers complete and submit to the department the flat monthly tax report that Patrick has described. It looks like this. And we have clerical staff that key punch the various items of data. Previous to the 1998 flat fee study, staff that performed the study would extract this data, which is key punched into a database known as the Highway Use Statistics Database. And we would then extract a report upon which the flat fee study would be predicated. An assumption was made that that report or extract from the Highway Use Statistics Database was reporting total miles operated, and it remained to be determined what percent of those total miles reported actually were exempt miles. And so a survey process was done to determine from the various categories of flat fee filers what percentage of their overall miles were in fact exempt miles. That percentage was then applied to the tallied up numbers from the Highway Use Statistics Report, and the flat fee study then made the comparison to what would have been paid under weight mile tax. It came to the attention of ODOT Financial Division staff that what they were commencing with was in fact taxable miles, or data from column number 8, which in fact would then be erroneously additionally reduced by a percentage of exempt miles, which may account for the fact that there's a variance between the various study years. Beginning with the 1998 study that included or reviewed 1997 data, there was a collaborative work group between ODOT and the various components of industry that had an interest that looked at the methodology and discussed, is there a better way? Rather than using a survey and asking folks to We've heard testimony that there are no records to speak of, and so we're asking folks to conjure up their best estimate of what percent of the miles are exempt. Why don't we simply assume that they're submitting a tax report, which is a valid document, and it is clear on its face what is being asked for, and let's use a sample of this data, and let's do the study. The work group reviewed the basis for constituting the sample. They reviewed the assumptions that were going to go into the study, et cetera, and the 1998 study was produced. The 1998 study showed a significant increase in the gap between the tax paid via flat fee and what should have been paid under a weight mile tax basis, which then caused, at that time, Bob McKellar, representing OFPTA, to suggest that perhaps his members and other folks that were paying flat fees did not, in fact, actually understand how to complete this tax form, and perhaps there was confusion. Mr. McKellar communicated that concern at that time to Director Krunikin. Director Krunikin asked me for my assessment. What do you think of that assertion that perhaps there was confusion about how to complete the tax report? And to answer that question, I went and just took a random day's receipt of these monthly flat fee reports, and I observed a significant diversity in the manner in which they were completed. Some taxpayers completed only column 7. Some taxpayers completed only column 8. Some taxpayers completed both 7 and 8, but put the same number in both columns. Some taxpayers completed 7 and 8 and had different numbers in both columns, but it lent some credibility that perhaps less than adequate care and attention was being devoted to the completion of the form. And so the notion of a different kind of survey was born. This time, we'll take a sample of these flat fee reports that were included in the flat fee, and I will write them a letter. And I will explain to them how the form is to be completed in detail, and I'll also tell them what the minimum records requirements are in the state of Oregon, and I gave them a copy of the administrative rule. And then even more importantly, I told them that it was significant that they invest the time to properly complete the form. And I explained to them to what end this information would be used and how it might reasonably incline the legislature to change or amend the flat fee tax rate. So it was worthy of their time and attention. And I asked them then, I gave them copies of their flat fee reports that we were looking at, and I said, would you like to amend these before we re-examine them? The response indicated that, as I recall, logs, for instance, had overreported taxable miles by 20%, as I recall. There was a much less, something on the order of 4 or 5%, I'm close, overstatement of taxable miles on sand and gravel. And the difference in chips was de minimis. We're only talking about 5 carriers. Now, the 1998 flat fee study, absent that follow-up survey data, had been submitted to DAS, to our consultant for the highway cost allocation study. The survey data came in afterwards, and it was shortly thereafter transmitted to the highway cost allocation study consultant at DAS, but it did not amend the 1998 report, nor was it included in the 1998 report. To make a long story short, there was much discussion about whether or not the study completed in 98 was accurate or not. And as a result, I do not believe that that was actually considered by the legislature in 1998. Now, when we came to the 2000 study, we also looked back at that 1998 discussion, and the discussion with the industry and the associations was is that we had gone through an educational process, and we asked them to be our partners in that, and we asked them to use the vehicle of their industry publications and to communicate with their own association members, as I had communicated with the study population, about the importance of completing the form correctly
and to what purposes the information was put, and they used their industry publications and did so. And the assumption at that point was made that we'd gone through an educational effort. We had agreed upon a study mechanism, so there was no discussion for purposes of the 2000 study as to how we ought to do the study. And so the industry did, in fact, request, can there be another collaborative team? ODOT made the determination that, well, there's no new decisions to make. We've settled upon a study methodology. We're going to repeat it, in essence, in the year 2000, so there's no new discussion. So there was no work study group. The study did change in the year 2000. The 2000 study released in early 2001, looking at 1999 data, was different in that it did not sample motor carriers. Rather, it sampled lines of data in the Highway Use Statistics database. So it obtained a more diverse sample. The sample was crafted by bona fide statisticians and the employee of the department, and statistical rigor was achieved. But the study methodology itself intentionally remained the same as was the case in 98. So there was deemed to be no new material to discuss. That, I think, is an explanation of the changing survey application in the flat fee study saga.
I don't think it's a saleable book.
New York Times bestseller. Okay.
All right. Greg, based upon information you just gave us and this graph, what do we need to do? I mean, are we talking about the fact that the payments are vastly short, or quite a bit short of what the actual liability is? If you were to sit here and divine what was the fair number, where would you think we were? Because, you know, we're all sitting here trying to make sure that every carrier is treated fairly in this process.
Mr. Chairman, I would observe that it has been fairly stated that ODOT has considered the option of simply deleting the flat fee option for paying weight mile tax. And we say that in full view of the amount of time that we're taking to perform the flat fee study, to involve a consultant at DAS to analyze the study results, to compute that with regard to the highway cost allocation study, to bring forward information to the legislature, and to have the legislature then entertain the time and energy to discuss what the appropriate tax rates are. So it becomes a question, I would think, to the legislature of whether the benefit of the flat fee system remaining in place legitimizes the costs of maintaining it. And it does have a care and feeding cost. Now, if I were to examine who, in essence, is taking advantage of the flat fee system, I recognize, and Dee correctly stated, that the original intent of the legislature was to provide a break to what Dee has called the mom-and-pop operator having one and two trucks. And if that is a fair characterization of what the legislative intent is, or was, then I think it's a fair observation to make that of the approximate $11 million that is paid annually via the flat fee, about 75% of that amount is paid by fleets operating more than two trucks. So a minority of the dollar amount is coming from fleets that are properly characterized as mom and pop, and a 75% majority of the tax is being paid by fleets that arguably are not mom and pop operations. Now, the inverse applies. That's the analysis from the dollars perspective. Actually, the inverse applies when you look at it in terms of number of motor carriers. There are approximately 530 motor carriers that are operating one or two trucks and paying flat fee out of a total of 745 motor carriers paying flat fee.
But those one and two truck operations are paying 28% of the tax. 73% of the tax is being paid by fleets operating substantially more trucks. And there are fleets with more than 25 trucks that are paying weight mile tax via flat fee. And fleets comprised of more than 25 trucks are actually paying 13% of all the flat fees. And so I think in answer to your question, the present reality has gotten away from the original legislative intent of what the flat fee was intended for. And perhaps to substantially narrow this gap, you simply limit the number of participants and the number of dollars at issue. And you do that by perhaps considering an amendment that would simply relegate the flat fee as being applicable to fleets of one or two trucks only, and that would seem to mirror the original legislative intent and would substantially narrow the gap.
Okay, thank you very much. I think everyone else signed up to testify on this.
Mr. Chair, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Very important. No, Mr. Chairman, that's it's the end of the list.
Well, I'm gonna, my read on this, first of all, we probably should deal with the word shall on line 18. And I think it may be a case for us to discuss some of the implications of what we've heard today. I think it's been very informative. Is it me and that mic? Okay.
I'm not clear, Mr. Chair. Are you suggesting that we pass this out today?
No, I'm saying that I think we need to give some consideration to the discussion that's occurred here, and then at least we have a great reason to at least look at removing the word shall or changing it to may, and look at the whole concept of where are we in relationship to this. I think these have been very informative, and for us to consider whether or not, in fact, there has been a change from what was the original intent to protect mom and pops to what are now commercial fleets, particularly in some parts of it.
That's a good point.
All right.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I just had a question. Mr. Del Ponte, if he could come back up.
He's going to write the next chapter in the book.
I haven't asked the question.
Do I get the answer?
Well,
sometimes.
I could have had some fun on that one. You gave us a pretty good breakdown. I'd like to have that in writing. I'm not sure I got it written down accurately on who pays what. But would you have any sense on the accuracy of the reporting from the larger fleets compared to the one and two truck operations?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Messerly, I would not. Common sense might tell me that the larger the operation, we're no longer dealing with the situation that Dee described as a kitchen table being the workplace, and perhaps there's an accounting department and a record-keeping department, and perhaps the business acumen increases correspondingly with the size of the business. That might be a question that ODOT audit staff might be able to help me with. Fortunately, they're here today.
Chair George, members of the committee, my name is Bob Otley. I'm the motor carrier audit manager with financial services at ODOT. And I was engaged in a conversation back there, so I didn't hear what you committed me to here.
The question was, would the accuracy of flat fee reports completed by the larger fleets likely be greater than the accuracy of flat fee reports completed by mom-and-pop type operators?
Purely a judgment call on my part. I would say I would expect that larger motor carriers would tend to be more accurate with their reports and would tend to rely on records for those reports more so than the small operations. But I have no hard data to back that up.
Generally, the types of audits that we get into, or the methodology of auditing a flat fee account, is significantly different than a carrier paying weight mile taxes on a monthly basis because of the flat fee option. One trip for the month constitutes the flat fee being paid, and an auditor is simply looking, were their trips made or not for a particular time period. Most of these kinds of audits tend to be in-house or desk audits because of the methodology and the method of payment.
Mr. Chair, so in your auditing operations, you have no way of taking the total miles that that vehicle ran for the year and then looking at the breakdown of the reports and see how that breaks out?
We would be, Senator George, Chair George, Senator Meserle, we would be relying on the tax reports primarily unless we were to go out and do a full field audit of the flat fee carrier. Then, of course, we would ask for all of the original records that made up that tax report, and through that means we would be able to make a comparison. But simply from the tax reports, I don't think we could make a fair comparison.
One more, Mr. Chair. So in your tax reporting forms, you do not require that they give the beginning mileage of the truck and the ending mileage of the truck, so you could get some sense of how accurate the reporting was?
Yes, they do, Senator George, Senator Meserle, yes, they do. They are required to maintain, or I should say the report asks for beginning and ending odometer readings, so in theory we would have the numbers that they put down on those tax reports to generate total miles. If we were to rely on the tax report, we could do a comparison, but short of going out and doing a full-fledged field audit, we wouldn't know how accurate those numbers are being entered on the tax report.
I have a question. Senator Meserle was saying, maybe this will sound too simplistic, but it would sound to me like after lunch someday, somebody could go to the file and say, you know, pull me out about three reports of someone with 24 trucks, and pull out about four reports of someone with two trucks, and I don't know about the accuracy of them, but I could certainly tell, I think, by looking at them, whether they're sophisticated, you know, they're loaded, they're unloaded, they're, you know, and whether there is a difference, just anecdotally in terms of as you suggested, you know, maybe in terms of the sophistication, how they're filling out. I mean, the sophistication itself would seem to tell me that they're probably working very hard on accuracy, and the other, and if they weren't very sophisticated, it would seem to me as an indicator that there wasn't that it may not be as accurate, and you know, maybe that's a simplistic approach, and it wouldn't be it wouldn't be definitive, but I think I could probably get some pretty good idea of just looking at a few of those and see if the way they're reported is different enough to justify the fact that there may be inaccuracies based on size of operation.
Senator George, Senator Metzger, you could certainly compare the tax reports and the form in which the numbers are entered. For example, a larger carrier, more sophisticated carrier, I think we might reasonably expect to see Oregon taxable miles and total taxable miles being different. On a smaller carrier, I don't think we would expect to see that same difference based on what we've seen. Some do, but I think your point's well taken there. We could not tell whether those are loaded miles or empty miles or partial loaded miles based on the information on the tax reports.
Senator Meserle.
Mr. Chair, I need to clarify for the record my line of questioning. I'm not suggesting at all that there's drivers or owners out here that are trying to mislead the public. Mm-hmm. What I am suggesting, from my experience in running our family's cattle operation trucks, that I do know how difficult some of this reporting can be. At least it was 6 years ago when I was doing it. And I've had experience where I was going in and out of state, on and off public roads, it can turn out to be a real hassle of trying to keep track of what you should be reporting, what you should be paying on or not. So what I'm very interested in is that we develop a process or a form that is much easier and much quicker to fill out and to keep track of, and maybe some incentives of why it would be to their advantage to do so, spend the time to do that. But, you know, I used to, when you're trying to get in the sleeper and get some sleep, spending a half hour to fill out your books and your paperwork sometimes, at the end of the day, particularly when you're using hired drivers, it's difficult to get that job done.
Craig, would you provide for us that list of the different class of carriers, particularly if you could give us those operators, the total number of one and two truck folks, and also the amount of tax that they are currently paying, what you would expect for the next year or so.
Senator George, I'll have that information to Patrick tomorrow morning.
Wonderful. Appreciate it. Any further questions? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 697. And with the tap of the gavel, is there anything further to come before the committee?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we will be adjourned.